In a world of EMS podcasters, EMS Office Hours is the only live podcast bringing you the latest topics and opinions in EMS. Turn down your scanner and turn up your speakers as we join Jim Hoffman and Josh Knapp on their latest EMS podcasting journey.
Hoffman.
And this is Josh Knapp.
Josh, here we are.
How you doing?
Okay.
One hell of a week, huh?
Yeah.
Holy crap.
Well, this episode of EMS Hours, Josh, as always, it's being sponsored by EMS Manager. I encourage listeners to go check out vemsmanager.net. They can get a free trial of this innovative and easy-to-use EMS employee scheduling and management software. I'll talk a little bit about that later on as well. But, Josh, I'm going to, you know, I kind of chose the topic tonight based on, you know, recent events with the, you know, this attack in Boston, the explosion in Texas. You know, these are big events, you know, that are unexpected, that are, if nothing else, you know, dangerous for providers to be, you know, running into. And I think, you know,
it's the stuff we train for and the stuff that we can't anticipate when we're there.
Yeah. You know, I have a couple of things that I wanted to sort of bring up. I mean, I don't want to rehash. I mean, listen, there's been a 24-hour news cycle on this stuff since it started, although I do think that the Texas, you know, end of it sort of got
fell between the cracks, right?
Yeah. Yeah, which is kind of unfortunate, you know, because we did lose, you know, some providers in that explosion. There were equal, you know, catastrophic stuff going on there. People, a lot of other people had died. You know, homes were lost. You know,
and a big, and powerful explosion. It was an unsafe working environment.
Did you see the mushroom cloud thing with that?
It was unfreaking believable. But yeah, I mean, I listen. It was funny when the Boston Marathon bombing went off. Did you remember seeing that explosion? And I know that you've seen, you know, videos certainly of high-powered explosions, suicide backpacks, you know, all the stuff that they emulate at New Mexico Tech, right? And that stuff is like C4 or AMFO, and it's high-powered stuff, you know? And you saw the one go off at Boston, you looked at it and you said, that's not a high-powered explosion, but it was. It sort of reminded me of almost fireworks, right?
Yeah.
If you looked at the cloud and stuff, but it's just a reminder, you know, all you need is the density.
Right. Doesn't take much.
Right. Right.
I mean, they talk about how those explosions are more, you know, really no more than a step above a pipe bomb, you know, but.
Right.
I mean, it was enough to kill a few people, and, you know, unfortunately, one of them was a child, and amputate, you know, limbs right there at the scene. You know, I'm gonna say, you know, the one thing that I kind of wanted to sort of focus on tonight, you know, you see the explosion happen, and you see the responders running to help. You know, they're ripping the fences down. They're pulling people out, taking them to ambulances, taking them to a triage area. And you know, this, so you're talking about EMS, fire, police. There were doctors on scene. You saw people who had physician vests on because they were sort of prepared because, you know, of a large event like that. They already had a lot of these people on standby to take care of the runners. You know what I mean?
Right.
So the response was pretty quick, and I read some things where it said, all of the injured were off the scene within 20 minutes and at the hospital within 20 minutes.
I mean, you know, I worked the New York Marathon.
Yeah.
And I've worked that for the last 10 years. And the preparation that goes into it and the – I'm I'm always reminded of, you know, the idea, the definition of an MCI. And the medical director in charge of that is in charge of a lot of sports events in around the country. He's a disaster preparedness guy. He's top of the mark. And he basically says, listen, this is, don't even kid yourselves. It's an all-in-all-out MCI. It's a controlled one.
Right.
But it's still an MCI.
Yeah, actually, when I used to work in Jersey, and they had the PNC Art Center there, that was an area where I worked.
Damn, you got crowds.
Yeah, and that would be also would be considered an MCI. Same type of thing. It's a controlled MCI, but you've got people drinking alcohol. You've got people tripping and falling. You've got people heat exhaustion. You know, all these things of the visitors and the attendees of these concerts and whatnot. So, you know, it's more of a controlled MCI. And something like this where it's not controlled and you've got sort of a immediate sort of mayhem going on, I sent out an email last week to my list, and it goes out to about maybe 8,000-9,000 people. And part of what I mentioned in there was talking about, never hearing EMTs or police officers or firefighters ask to be called heroes, And I got a little bit of flack from that. I had one person say that, they had a physician on the scene who said that, a big reason why there were so few fatalities was because there was a lot of physicians and nurses there to provide emergent care, and that it wasn't just EMS, PD, and FD, And I'm like, well, I'm not acknowledging the fact that there were doctors on the scene. But at the same time, I sort of feel like the physician saying that is almost like they're looking for recognition. Right? So it sort of proves my point. Prove my point about EMS and fire and stuff not wanting to be called heroes, but you get a doctor who's saying, well, the big reason why there was so few fatalities because we had so many doctors and nurses there. Now I don't know about you, and I don't know these doctors and nurses. I don't know what their situation is, what their experiences are. But when I've had doctors and nurses on trauma calls and MCIs that show up, they get in the way.
Yep.
I'm sorry. It is what it is.
But there's two different levels. I mean, you're dealing with major metropolitan area and you're dealing with a lot of the ER docs, and so they're the ones, they have been there and done it and seen it in some cases. I mean, you get two levels really at these events. You get a lot of interns, a lot of people sort of trying to make their mark. You know what I mean? And then you get the guys who are sort of in charge of it and really, the up level of it and getting paid. And they've been there, they've done it, or they're volunteers, but they've been there, done it, and volunteered for a while. Right. And, anybody, at this event, you looked at it and everybody, even the bystanders, were contributing something.
Right. You saw bystanders getting involved. They were trying to help. I'm not saying it was just, EMS and police and fire that was doing all the rescuing or doing all of the grunt work. There was a lot of, you saw people with physician vests on, nursing vests on. Marathon personnel. You had people from the marathon themselves. And the workers from the marathon were helping. And again, bystanders, other runners, you saw them all helping. But from my point of view, I'm an EMS website. This is an EMS podcast. And, to me, just seeing the professionalism that was done there, the way that everybody was identified, everybody had a uniform on that was there as a paramedic, as an EMT, and I think that helped lessen some of the confusion as to who was who. I mean, think about the event, right? It's like you hit two bombs go off within, a few seconds of each other. And, excuse me, as a provider, as an emergency, you've had the training, you've sat through CMEs, and you're aware now, okay, this is some sort of an attack, whether it's domestic, foreign, whatever the case may be.
Right. Now, it's low probability it's an accident.
Right. And now you don't know if the person next to you now who is not identifiable, who is not in any type of a uniform and doesn't have any type of a vest on, who are they? Are they a best bystander trying to help? Are they somebody who's looking to cause more damage? You don't know, you know.
Right.
And there's a danger in that. You know, there's a danger in that thought process, and it's hard to sit back as someone who wasn't there and
armchair quarterback it.
Right, and sort of second guess their response, and second guess the fact that there wasn't a lot of concern, or at least outwardly concern, for secondary explosives.
You know, that's exactly what I was thinking. And there's two ways to sort of approach this. One is, you know, listen, we can't armchair quarterback. We were not in that situation. Just like, you know, people look back at 9/11 and said, you know, oh, what you should have done. If you weren't there, shut up. But on the other hand, you know, there is that practical sense of where our training is. And I think that sort of roundabout draws back to what you were originally saying of who gets in the way. You know, fire, police, EMS, we drill on this stuff. I mean, if especially you're a large municipality, you're sort of, you know, there are those group drills, those big drills. Not everybody gets to go, but you usually get the reports. You usually get some trickle down from it, what was learned, what's good, what's bad. And then you get your awareness seminars, and you get your CMEs and stuff like that. And every time you go to a terrorist CME, what's the thing that they tell you now? Secondary, even tertiary devices.
Because they want to hurt the responders.
Right. And what's it? And as an example, what do they show you? They show you the abortion clinic bombings back in the 90s with Eric Rudolph.
Right.
And what did he learn? He learned his first bomb, these guys were really lucky. The car blocked that secondary device. The second bomb, what did he do? He placed it up. So it would be sure to get there, and sure enough, more people were injured. Yeah. And, you know, it's like you immediately think a bomb goes off, and there are people that rush in, but wasn't your – when you watch that go down, you were like, hold on a sec, you know, take a breather, assess what's going on around you?
And I think this is where it gets to be that really fuzzy and really sticky situation. You've got people who are injured. You've got people screaming for help. And what do you do with the provider? Do you stand there and say, whoa, I can't go in there until the scene is safe? Until they come and get a bomb dog here or something, make sure it's not a secondary device waiting for me to get close enough and blow off and kill me. You know, I mean, quite honestly, I mean, I know myself. I'd be one of those people running in to help. You know, I know myself. I know.
Oh,
I know I wouldn't.
Yeah.
Be
what's your first response? I mean, when you were watching that, do you remember? Listen, like anything, you know, you remember where you were when you got the news.
For
the bombing.
Sure, yeah.
You know, I mean, what was your first response? You ran to a TV. You were, it's like, what the fuck?
I turned the TV on and saw it. And, well, I actually just wrote a blog post about it because I saw it on the TV. And then I said, holy shit. And I ran to Facebook because I knew people who were – I knew Greg Fries. He was running in a marathon. And you know, Carissa O'Brien
was he? Did he finish?
He finished. He finished. He,
damn,
one of the people who already passed this. But you know, and I wrote on Facebook about. I mean, I wrote a blog post about it, talking about how you know Facebook can be useful in that way. It can be the type of tool that can sort of get that communication when it comes to that. And it was funny because I went on Facebook. And there were people way ahead of me that were on there asking if he was safe, where is he, you know, and they were saying, Greg, please check in, stuff like that. Because you get worried and you realize, holy, you know, I know somebody in that race,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you want to, you know, react, you know. But when you watch these videos and you see the people running towards where the explosions happened, you know, you can't help but think, okay, if I was in that situation, what would I do? And I think most providers, and I think most people you're going to talk to are going to tell you, well, I probably would have been running towards the two. The idea of secondary devices being planted to hurt responders, I think for most of us, you know, while we're aware of it, and while I think people might think of it after the fact, I think in the heat of the moment, most of us don't think of it. And I think it's going to eventually come back to bite us in the ass. You know?
Wait, what's going to come back and bite us in the ass?
The fact that we don't sort of stage and make sure it's not a secondary device before racing in. There's going to be times, I think, where these people, these terrorists.
They're going to learn.
They're going to learn.
Do you think people didn't watch this, the effectiveness of what happened? I mean,
you think about, well, that's the thing, too, even with this, right? You've got the explosion. You've got all the responders going there. And you've got a lot. If you look at the video, there was a large amount of responders that were there almost immediately because you had a lot of people on standby because of the size of the event. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about being able to take out, you know, a large amount of responders, which includes these physicians and nurses that were there who don't have even the response training. Who might not even be aware of the fact that they, you know, who might not have been trained or you know, made aware of the fact that there could be these secondary devices there, and you know, goes off. But again,
well, here's a chilling. Wait a second. You know, these guys were sort of, you know, the stories more and more coming out that they were, I don't want to call them amateurs, but they weren't like professionals, and you know, we've seen. Professional, if you want to put that word around it, planning. And if they wanted to, I mean, if you really wanted to cause devastation at that, wouldn't you have targeted where the ambulance stage? Wouldn't you have had many? I mean, think of it, September 11th, how many hundreds of people were involved in the planning of it? How many people, how many tens of people were involved in the execution of it? Wasn't like 30 people involved in the execution of that?
And that's the thing, too. I think in this case, I mean, quite honestly, I think they even probably, I mean, I would think, you know, that even detonating these bombs, that they would have done it more towards the beginning of the race where you had more people there watching the winners come across the finish line, you know, things like that.
Well,
but they might have had the detonation early on to not only get a bigger crowd that might have been watching the finish of, you know, of the initial, the winners of the race, but also to disrupt the entire race. I mean, think about all the thousands of runners that didn't get to finish, you know, because of it.
Yeah, but the dynamics of the race, actually that part I thought was done pretty well, because the dynamics of the race are the finishers, the first, the elite runners, as they say, usually cross the finish line in like a couple hours. You know, you have the winner, you know, Laura, you know, sometimes they're from Kenya or wherever they are, and they're the elite runners.
Why is that?
Because they're used to the altitude.
They're always winning.
I mean, they're just fantastic runners, you know.
Yeah. But I watched the race. I just want to have a sandwich.
Right. I order it from Taco Bell.
Yeah.
But then you get the masses of the, you know, the most of the finishers, and they're finishing in the, you know, 3 hour, 3 to 5 hour range, 3 to 4 hour range. And so really when you want the density of runners crossing the finish line, where you're going to have the cameras, where you're going to do the most damage, that was timed pretty well. And if you notice, they timed one and then they timed the other down the road. Now, if they were really looking to cause devastation, wouldn't it have been time one, put the second bomb right there, right where the first bomb went off, and time it 4 minutes, 5 minutes later?
Right. Exactly.
I mean, imagine what happened then.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what you're saying, right? You know,
sure.
Secondaries.
And this is the thing, though. It's like, and again, you know, I sent that email out, and I did have one person who said, you know, that they totally appreciate what I wrote and all, but they did say, and they said they have a sobering thought, and that's that, you know, a dead EMT, a dead firefighter, or police officer can't help anyone, and that we need to start thinking self-safety. And they mentioned, like we just said, too, you know, how many lectures have you heard of secondary device designed just to kill responding personnel?
And it's scary, right? And the other aspect that's scary is, what's the impact when, you know, to the responders, when a responder goes down? Yeah. You know, there's not a zero emotional quotient there. There's a high impact.
You're talking about an even higher emotional stress when providers get injured. I think about 9/11, and you think about the
my stomach just tightened.
You know, the people that people would be trying to be saved in the buildings, but then when you start seeing firefighters and EMS and cops that are being killed, you know, by the dozens now. It's like, okay, now it's like personal, right?
Right.
And it's unfortunate. And like I said, though, you know what? I think most people probably listen to this podcast while they're aware of the secondary danger. They're aware of this training and probably been through the training. When it comes down to it, I think most of us would have done exactly what everybody there did.
And it's really, really hard because when do you time? You know, I've taught the awareness class a lot, and I always kick it off with the idea of, you know, why we're there, where what's going on in the world, a little bit of politics, and then I go, listen, you know, some event happens. I like to use this, you know, the title from the song "Fools Rush In," and it's like, you know, if you're going to be useful, you can't help anybody if you're injured. If you're running in and you're not aware of the second device, you're going to be part of the problem. You're going to be another statistic.
Yeah.
And you just sort of have to backstep that with when you're in the heat of the moment and people are going down and your adrenaline is pumping, you know, you're there to save lives. I mean, let's not, you know, dance around that. We're there to save lives. What's our first response? And what's the second thing? Time is of the essence. You know, the golden hour and everything else. So what a conflict you have going on.
Yeah. And yes, that's the thing, too. It's this thing, like, you know, people are running away and we're running towards the danger. We're not thinking about our families and things like that. We're thinking about the families of the people who are hurt. And you know, we're concerned about that, about, like you said, saving lives. And some comment that I made in the email, and I wasn't going to write it in the email initially, but it kind of hit me a little bit that if ever it was more evident, you know, for EMS, you know, that day when you see that what they were doing and how they're running to these emergencies, you know, in the Texas explosion as well, it applies, you know, truly we are not here for the pay, you know.
Yeah, all right.
Because, you know, there was no thought about who was getting paid what when the time came. You know, there was more thought about, I think, you know, saving the lives of people, helping each other, you know, and also I think, you know, falling back on the training that we have.
You know, we've talked about this in some of the other episodes about pay and the type of person involved. And, you know, one of the things that sort of comes up time and time again, besides the idea that we're sort of being cheated out of a honest living, so to speak, is the aspect that if you're in it for the pay, you get filtered out pretty quickly.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, the people who stick around.
That's very true, though, Josh. That is so true, because I think that if you come into it thinking you're gonna make, you know,
earn money while sleeping.
Yeah, I think you, if you're not really in it to help people at your core, like you said, I think you don't last very long, you know, or you become somebody who is this burnt out person, you know.
Yeah, you become somebody who's not helping anybody anyway.
Yeah. I mean, listen, we all joke around, you know, we make fun, we have sarcastic sort of half burnt attitude about the drunks we deal with and the, you know, the shucking the old people back and forth to the hospital. But, you know, when stuff like this happens, like this explosion in Texas and this bombing in Boston, you know, this is when that we put those attitudes aside.
Didn't you feel a sense of solidarity with EMS in Boston? I mean, didn't that sort of, you know, your gut check?
I tell you, you know, with these guys. It brings back a lot of memories, you know, and feelings I felt with 9/11. And
oh, totally.
you know, it's sort of this thing where, and I'm sure other responders across the country felt the same when 9/11 happened. They wanted to be there to help. You know, they had a desire to be there. You know, it's like you almost say, "Oh man, I wish I was closer. I can go help out." You know.
You know, there's a part of critical incident stress and PTSD that actually happens. It's called, you know, survivor's guilt,
Oh
but it
yeah.
happens. But that's, you know, and that's sort of a separate thing. But there's a subcategory of that, and it's a major stress for first responders who feel like they could have gotten there, or they could have responded or should have
Right.
responded and didn't or couldn't or were prevented.
Yeah.
That really, you know, you're trained. You know, you go through the pain of the hours and hours of training and practical experience and time on the road, so you're going to be available at that point in time when the big thing happens, and then you can't get there. You
Yeah.
know, you it, that puts a lot of that puts a lot of stress on providers as well.
Yeah.
I happen to know a few that were that has still carry a major guilty
Yeah,
conscience
I knew a
sometimes.
few people too who ended up being diagnosed with that same thing, that survivor's guilt because of it. And you first hear something like that, you're like, "Come on, give me a break." But then you think you when you think about it, you know, it is a valid thing because of the fact of what how we feel as individuals and the calling we have to be in EMS or be a police officer or a firefighter. You know, you again, like you said, it's that desire to help. It's that desire to feel like you're making a difference, and that when nobody else can be there and doesn't have the training, you've got that training. You've got that desire to be there. You know, so it's a type of thing where, you know, you pretty much are the one that people look to for help, you know.
Yep.
So you know, it's just, you know, again, it's not something where I don't want people listening to this show and saying, "Oh my God, these guys are Monday morning quarterbacking here," you know. Because like I said, when I first mentioned as far as looking at for secondary devices and things like that, you know, I admit heartily that I am sure that if that happened and I was on the scene, there would not be a thought for a secondary device. As much as I've been to numerous, you know, training for MCIs and terrorist training where they sort of almost drill that into your head, and they give examples, like you said, with the abortion clinic and stuff, and examples of stuff that would go on and that went on in Iraq and Afghanistan, and I talk about that.
Time and time again, it's not
Right.
like it's a passing thing. It's
Right.
not like it's a one-off. It's not like it's, you know, oh, this happens occasionally. This is expected. It happens all the
And
time.
the sad thing is, I think that eventually, you know, these things keep happening here in the States. Eventually, it's going to be happening that way as well. They're going to smarten up. They're going to realize how they can do it. And they're going to end up doing that. You know, it's just so frightening, you know.
You know, I gotta say, you know, and I look back on it and the same, I have the same feeling, the same gut check that you do. If that happened in front of me, especially when you had another explosion a few seconds later, or a few minutes later,
Yeah.
and you know, you sort of think, okay, that's it. But I tell you, I would be going in, but the hairs on the back of my neck would
Right.
be
You'd
at
be
full attention.
sure. But I think that's part of just in general. I think everyone that would go in the back of their mind, it's like, get out.
Right.
You know what I mean?
But
Because of that.
isn't that the, I mean, you know, you and I have both done some hairy jobs,
But
Jim.
that's part of, I think,
And
of
that's,
our training. And I
right.
think that's just part of I think even human nature, you know, of, you know, what am I doing in this dangerous situation? You know, the fight or flight thing, you know what I mean? You know, you've got that element that's telling you that you should not be in that situation. And the
How
fact that
many,
we
what,
have this training that tells us, in addition, that there could be a secondary device, dummy, don't be there.
Right.
You know, that makes it even more, I guess, evident for us that we don't want to,
I think it almost unfairly, if you want to use the word, I know I'm going to catch grief for this, but it almost unfairly puts us in harm's way, because really the truth is, Jim, what choice do you got?
Well, again, you don't have all that much, because when you've got, like you said, two explosions go off, the draw is to go to it. You've got people beckoning you to go to it.
Right.
You've got cops on the radio telling you to get there, you know.
Right.
You've got, you know, people who are screaming for help, and you know that, you know, the bottom line is that you're there to help. You know, you are it. You know,
hey,
it's funny. I have like a running gag with people at my job where they'll start talking about that. Oh my God, I walk into this house and I look down. The guy is having a full blown, you know, seizure and stuff. And I looked at him. I said, "What do? You turn over, look over your shoulder and scream medic."
Yeah,
right. Because you can't. You're it. Yeah. The shit's hitting the fan, and you got no one to look over your shoulder at. You're it.
Remember when you first became a medic? I mean, I know the CRS kicks in, you can't remember shit, but back those are some pretty stark images. When you're first there and you're like, you're carrying your drug bag and you're all proud, and you have your monitor on one hand, one side, your drug bag on the other, I'm a medic, and you go in and the person's full out, you know, in the shit, and you go, "Where's the medics?"
Right. Yeah, it's not always, you know. So where's the chest pain? Nine on, you know, scaling with the 10, how bad is it? You know, sometimes it's, you know, the shit hitting the fan. And you're looking around to yell for a medic, and you have to glance at your patch on your shoulder, and you go, "Oh, wait, that's me."
Yeah, right.
And this is the same type of thing. It's like, you know, who am I calling help for? I'm the help.
That's it.
And I think, and like, you know, like some of the feedback I got from the email I sent out, as far as that goes, is that we have to start, I guess, thinking about that. And I think that when we do planning for this, it's something that we have to maybe have in place, you know, to tell people, okay, if this happens, you know, at this event, you know, wait until this before you start responding, you know. Because just the fact that you're just supposed to be aware of the fact that you've got a secondary device that could possibly be there isn't enough, because we're going to respond. We're not thinking about that secondary device. We're going to respond.
You know, Lewis, I have a major thing to say about it. It's not even just explosives that we have to respond to, but we're at the half hour, so let me let you do your thing. Let's pay some bills here.
Yeah, let me talk about EMS Manager real quick, because there is one thing I want to mention, and I'll talk about the Texas thing a little bit too. Again, I really feel that kind of got brushed away, but just a little bit of EMS Manager, guys. Again, we are sponsored by EMS Manager. They are a really great piece of employee scheduling and management software for EMS provider. They make it easy for you to set it up, and it's very easy to maintain and manage. So they got mobile apps for it. They've got a web app for it. You can get it from your smartphone, pretty much anywhere where you have an internet connection. So even managers and staff can both access it depending upon whatever settings you make. But they can both access it. They can make requests. They can manage requests and make changes to employee schedules from anywhere as long as you've got an internet connection. So price is based on the size of your organization, so it's always affordable. And because it's web-based, like I just mentioned, your employee scheduling software is located in the cloud, and that makes it much easier to manage, and that means there's no additional IT costs to worry about. There's always free training, there's always free tech support and free system software updates. So if you want to go ahead and check this out for your EMS system, your agency, check it out for free. You can get a customizable trial of EMS Manager at emsmanager.net. Now, EMS Manager is sponsoring EMS Office Hours as well as a lot of the other EMS programs from the ProVent Network, so I want to thank them for that. And EMS Manager is proud to support EMS providers and managers through this sponsorship. Show your support for them in exchange, guys. Go check them out. Take a few minutes. Get their free trial over at emsmanager.net. It's from Aladtech. It's EMS Manager for Online Employee Scheduling and Workforce Management. Again, it's emsmanager.net. Be sure if you do sign up, guys, tell them that Jim and Josh sent you there from EMS Office Hours. So, Josh, I want to make your point because I wanted to talk a little bit about the Texas thing. So I know you wanted to make a point about the bombings and the bullets. So
you know, yeah, and the Texas
kind of tie in, but you know, go ahead and do that, and then we can move on a little bit.
Oh yeah, we definitely got to jump on Texas, but I'll segue to that because there's another part of it, and you know, I teach the WMD, weapons of mass destruction. That you know, bombs are just one frickin' part of it. You know, we're first responders. You know, what if we get the person with the high fever and the cough? You know, is it the flu or is it, you know, smallpox? You know, what? And they're all going to present, all those biologics are going to present the same. Or if you think of the Tokyo sarin gas attacks, you know, chemicals are around. They're more expensive. They're harder to produce, but they're there too. So, you know, we walk into a situation, we see somebody down, and I like to say if you see, you know, three people at a subway corner and they're all lying on the ground seizing, it's not because they had an epilepsy.
Yeah, they didn't have it. Yeah, exactly. They didn't pre-plan their seizure.
Right.
Well, it's funny you say that because I posted tonight's link on the GEMS Facebook page, and as I was getting ready to log off there, I saw somebody asked a question. They gave a little bit of scenario, which I think is something that is what you're talking about as well, where you talk about EMS crew that responds to a street job and the patient has a backpack. So think about it, though. You know, could the EMS crew...
It's like really, everybody?
Well, the thing is, right, the EMS crew could unintentionally escort a potential IED into a hospital behind normal hospital security, mm-hmm. right, and get that inside the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're asking, should we be able to search these types of patients?
Oh, Christ! Yeah,
so this really is a concern. I think, and I read that, I was like, wow, you know, that's valid.
That's a great question,
and I think a good point to bring up during the show. So I sort of just kind of sidebarred that for tonight, and hopefully to get to it. But I mean, think about it. It's not just backpack; it's anything. You know, they could have anything on them. And what if you don't search their bag? You know,
listen, you know, you've worked the hood. You know concealed weapons. You know a knife in the pocket and the waistband. There's sometimes, a razor on a chain. So, and there, you know, that whole thing with the loose fitting clothes and the chain. Yeah. So when the guys are doing a body search on you, you're leaning forward, the chain is leaning off your neck, and the weapon is hanging out away from your body. So the cops are doing the body search. They're not, you know, picking up that you are, you have a weapon on you. There's a whole bunch of stuff. First thing comes to mind though is where are we trained to search something, and would you want to open up a backpack?
Right, I was just going to say, like, what do you do with that now? Are you going to start now when you ever get anybody who has a backpack, you know, calling the cops to search it? And then what cops are really trained? You're going to treat every backpack as a potential bomb? I mean, it's like, you know, listen, it's upsetting in some ways too, man, because you think about the bombing in Boston, right? Before we get on to the Texas thing, I know I do want to move on to it, but you think about, they did the bomb, two bombs went off, right? They injured 100 or so people, killed a few people, right? But the entire city was shut down, right, for like a day and a half.
Longer.
Right? So they more or less, they
How
crippled,
many billions did that cost?
Right, they crippled a major city by doing this. So in essence, the terror itself, you know, caused damage, explosions, you know, mayhem, whatever. But financially, like you said, financially, what did they do? You know, and you're talking about a big city. They crippled the big city for days, you know, by doing this. So they won, and you know, they sort of gained, I guess, what they were looking to do by having the effect of the bombs. But they even gained even more by being able to cripple the city and financially damage, you know, the city as well. you know, and I just, it's just amazing to me, and it's frightening to think that it's the type of thing that could go on. It could increase, you know, especially when you get these people that are homegrown sort of terrorists that are not coming from overseas, and they're sympathetic to the that thought process, you know, and they're, you know, doing it here. And we have so many targets here that you can think of.
Well,
from movie theaters to mass transit to malls to schools to...
Jim, a lot of people events. Forget
you
the,
know,
the main... You know, you're right. A lot of people also forget, though, the main point of 9/11 wasn't just to cause a spectacular incident. I mean, that was...
Right.
That was a driving point, but remember the main point was to bring down America by attacking their capitalist center, you know, the World Trade Center. That was, you know, it was supposed to be a financial hit. You know, it was a hit that cost trillions upon trillions of dollars in the end. You know, they're never going to really figure out how much. You know, you can put a exact number on a building. You can even put an exact number on a life if you want to get that gruesome. But you know, all the cross business that was all the business that wasn't conducted, besides the money that was lost. I mean, that costs money too. You know, we roll into how devastating that was to to New York and certainly the U.S. But, you know, what's the ramifications of a fertilizer factory? You know,
well, you
to
think
a
about
small
that?
Town in Texas, I'm sure it's a big one.
Yeah. I mean, that too, I think, comes into a lot of issues with training. I mean, apparently wasn't the explosion caused by the fact that they weren't aware that you couldn't put water on it?
You know what?
I talked to a firefighter,
okay,
who was telling me that you know, by itself it's not really dangerous. But when they went there because there was something on fire because of the chemicals or whatever that were there, when you put water on it, it's extremely explosive.
Well, you know what? I would have to.
I forget
know.
The name of it. I don't.
Right.
You know, I'm not going to pretend I know about these chemicals and stuff. But you know,
they have some pretty volatile chemicals. I mean, for sure, if you can use basic fertilizer as the basis for a major a tertiary explosive. And for folks who don't know, there are three levels of explosive. There's the sort of the immediate ignition, and then there's an explosion that's the primary, and then there's like an exploding body, and you could call something like TNT or gunpowder that exploding body, and then there's a tertiary type of explosive like AMFO or you know, fueled fertilizer that creates more energy, that just provides more energy to the explosion. And that's really what, you know, fertilizer does. So, I mean, they deal with some crazy-ass stuff in these chemical processing plants.
Yeah. I mean, listen, you know, everything from what I did, I think there were like 14 people ended up getting killed, and you had about 200 or so others that were
Did you
injured.
See that? That one, the video clip of the guy who was, he was probably about a half a mile away filming it from his car.
Uh-huh.
Or was it, I wasn't sure if it was an ambulance crew or who it was. It was a YouTube video, and you hear a woman in the background saying, "Let's get out. I can't hear, let's get out."
Yeah.
That was, I mean, think of the power that's needed. You know, that was just half a mile away. You know, hopefully, you know, you've all been exposed to some sort of explosion, at least at the 4th of July. And those are a few hundred yards in the air, and they thump through you, you know, and they're exhilarating.
Right. Yeah.
But, you know, imagine something that's that far away and can still kill you, you know, and it sort of stretches your imagination. And it should give you pause to say, you know, and I was sort of thinking, you know, here's a fertilizer plant, you know, a really, listen, we have the chemical plants in New Jersey, the petroleum plants. I mean, those are volatile. How close would you want to get to one of those? And that's sort of where, you know, at the first part of this conversation where he's talking about how do you respond? Mm. You know, that's going off. You know there's an absolute probable danger to life and limb in that, and there's no place far enough away to get, and there are people on scene in the thick of it that need your help. What do you
do? Right. Yeah, it's the same. It's very similar, man. It's very similar to what we've been talking about, where you're not going to say, well, you know, it's too hot. Fire's too hot. I'm not getting that close. And, you know, and you have to ask yourself, should we be doing that? You know, should we be the ones that are saying, okay, you know what? I'm going to do every freaking EMS you go to, right? What a BSI, scene safety, BSI.
And so you have your gloves on.
Right. So what happens? Like, right out the window that goes. You know, you got this explosion, you got the bombing thing, and again, right out the window it goes. You know, I mean, when I first became an EMT years ago, it's like I got caught up in the scene where there were, you know, many there were dozens of people who were dropping like flies from CO poisoning. You know, and I went in there like an idiot because I'm thinking, okay,
well, you're impervious to CO poisoning,
yeah,
aren't you?
Well, the thing is that you get the you know, the call for vomiting and stuff like that, and you walk in and you look around and the entire house of 6, 7, 8 people are vomiting, and then they start seizing, and you're like, what in God's name is going on here? And then you realize, okay, I've got an issue on my hands. You know, same, like I mentioned before, you look over your shoulder looking for the help. You know, where's EMT? Where's EMS? Oh, wait, that's me. You know, and then you start, I mean, I started going down, you know, knocking on every door in the apartment complex and evacuating the building. And in the process, I became, you know, one of the casualties. I became exposed to it, you know. And if you've ever had radial blood taken.
That sucks.
Yeah, it hurts.
I've seen that a couple of times.
Yeah. And, you know, me and my partner both had to have, you know, radial blood drawn several times, you know, until it was clear and we were able to leave. But we both became, you know,
how
patients.
Sick did you get too?
Not too bad. I mean, it was more lightheadedness and a little nauseousness more than anything else. You know, because pretty much we had kids. There were kids in there. We had, you know, my partner had two kids, you know, one under each arm. I had a kid in my arms, and we're going down the stairs. And as we're doing it, we're kicking on doors, telling people to get out of the building, you know.
Yep.
And this is something where you sort of take that with you throughout your career, that the potential is there for you to become, you know, part of the, you know, part of the scene, part of the environment, you know. And but again, would I have done anything differently? Probably not, because it's the type of thing where, okay, now I'm looking, I'm in this apartment, I see people. You know, like you said, three people seizing at one time, you know that it's not three people seizing at one time. There's something else still going on there, you know. But it's the type of thing where I could have just easily just ran out of the house, you know, but instead I delayed my, you know, my egress by grabbing people and
getting them out of there. And
right,
doing what
knocking on doors to get other people out that, you know, because who knows? Who knows behind the doors of on the same floor that I was on that there weren't, you know, people who were unconscious or dead behind those doors.
You know, and it's funny because we were both saying, you know, well, we're just doing what we're trained to do. But the truth of the matter is, in that situation, what are you trained to do?
Right.
And so you're going against that, right?
That's the thing, right? BSI safety, right out the window it goes.
Is the takeaway from this podcast that, you know what, you know, yeah, we get the training, yeah, we get the practice, all that, but when we're really in the thick of it, we just revert back to our animal instincts and do what we feel is the right thing to do?
Yeah, I think so. I think in the end, you know, I think we actually end up doing that, man. I think that ends up being what happens. It's like, yeah, that's nice to know, but I'm going to go help somebody.
Yeah. Sobering, something we should think about.
It is something I think and again, it's not that I think you and I are trying to play Monday morning quarterback here. We're recognizing the adrenaline, the desire to help, the being in the situation. That was part of tonight's podcast, right? Was the situation awareness, knowing that there could be a secondary bomb or whatever going off there versus the actual situation. And when I say the actual situation, I mean the reality of this job, you know? And the reality is that when the shit hits the fan, most of us don't concern ourselves with our own safety, you know? And I think, like I said earlier, man, I think it's going to end up coming back to bite us if these types of events keep happening, where they're going to get smart enough to start planting secondary devices and start trying
to... Tertiary devices, yeah. Strategizing where we're going, right. Who's exactly. Going to get it.
Exactly. And, you know, but you know what? I'm going to tell you this much. I think even if that happens, I don't think it's going to change anybody's response. You know?
Yep.
Anybody any less hesitant to go in? I think it's going to hit us harder as providers and as emergency providers because we care about each other, you know, a little bit more than we care about the people that we're treating at times. And I think that, you know, it's going to make us aware that, yeah, it can happen, but I don't think it's going to slow us down.
It's who we are, man.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to slow us down a lot at all. I mean, you know, you're not going to think about it, you know, and that's just the fact, I guess, of what we're doing in this job. And I go back to what I mentioned earlier. You know, we're not, if anything else, it's this type of thing and what went on with Texas and Boston and the amount of danger that we put ourselves in is evident that we're not doing it for the pay.
Yeah. You know?
And I'm sure a lot of the Texas people were volunteers as well.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's pretty evident that we're not really in it, you know, for the money. You know
it's sort of interesting because, you know, a lot of times we do these podcasts and we have some sort of definitive takeaway from them, you know, some sort of, and we say we're not here to answer these questions.
Of course not.
I mean,
not.
You say that all the time.
Right.
But, you know, this is one especially that's really going to be just real foggy, and we're going to lead to more losses. It's just going to happen. And I don't see a way out of it, Jim.
No, I don't, and that's the thing either. That's the other thing. I don't see... Oh yeah, you can sit here. You can say shame on you for running into the fray, you know, and not thinking about a secondary device. You know, shame on you for not pre-planning enough in Texas and you know being aware of the type of explosions that could happen at a plant like that. You know what I mean? The bottom line is that we're doing what we're trained to do, and you know the side training about our own safety, you know, it's like, again, it goes out the window when it comes to the training we have for helping other people. That's the training that we always tend to focus on more, you know, and this whole thing, again, with the scene safety BSI and stuff, it's like, you know, yeah, that's nice to know, but I'm not listening to that.
You know, I can sit there and just sort of say, you know, maybe – The idea that we're talking about it, the idea that it's in the conversation, is enough of the thing to eventually make the change. I mean, you think about it, you know, the bravado of running to calls and we didn't wear seat belts. We knew about traffic accidents at the very beginning. I mean, we were there because of highway traffic accidents. That's why EMS was basically formed.
Yeah.
And you know, so we knew seatbelts saved lives. We knew the type of cars that were safer than others. And yet, how many, you know, EMS even to this day ride through like crazy through the streets and don't even wear a seatbelt. But with that said, there are more and more people, more and more responders who do take the care. It used to be that, you know, firefighters had to get their leather lungs, you know, had to breathe in some smoke before they were really firefighters.
Right.
Now they know, now they have the Scott packs on, you know, when they're in the wrong wind direction.
Right.
So, you know, maybe there's some hope there. Maybe we are learning.
Yeah, I mean, listen, again, it's not, we like we always say, like you just mentioned, we don't have answers for this. I mean, you know, something that on Twitter, Win for Me had said on Twitter about asking the question on the podcast was the West Texas, was West Texas trained for this fertilizer explosion? You know, and it's hard to say. I don't know enough about it to make a judgment on it.
But you can guarantee the next batch in will be.
Right. And that's the thing. It's you know, there's...
We pay a heavy price for that.
Right. Yeah. And Tactical Intel mentioned what I mentioned as well on Twitter, talking about, you know, what do you do? Do you sit back and let PD secure the scene? You know, and again, it's easy to armchair, but when there's people bleeding, you know.
Yeah. That wasn't happening in this
case. That's not happening.
That's not an option.
You know, so just, you know, Daniel G. Johnson mentions, I asked a question, did they even think about secondary devices in Boston? Why are they not? He said they are called first responders for a reason.
Yeah, but that's not an excuse. That's, you know, situational awareness is understanding the components that fit
it's part of the response. Right, it's part of the response. But my point is that, you know, the bottom line is that we don't think about it. You know, we don't think about it. We think about everybody else but ourselves. And I think the takeaway, like we mentioned, Josh, the takeaway is going to be that we're going to be thinking about everybody else besides ourselves, right, no matter how much training we have for our own personal safety or not. And again, we probably will end up losing responders in the process down the line if these situations.
It's a dangerous
happening.
Shot by its definition.
Yeah, it's yeah. You know, but
I gotta say,
we could do is hope that, you know, we can prevent these things from happening. You
in
know?
The chat room, RJ Rescue Humor, he said, you know, he wanted to add in situational awareness, just to remember, you know, your first call, your first description of what the hell's going on from dispatch is not always the call that you get. And I sort of laugh at that, and it's like, you know, when is it the call you get? But
yeah,
the other
rarely.
But the other side of that is, you know, that's where experience, that's where situational awareness, which is a thing that first responders should know, you know, and should understand that they need to learn more about, is a component. You know, is the call coming in the right picture? You know, are there five seizing patients all of a sudden? You know, you know, where does that make sense?
I know. Well, Josh, let's end it there. I mean, again, we're not going to come up with a resolution for this. I hope people listening sort of feel where we're coming from, you know, and I encourage people to make comments on the blog at emsofficehours.com or right here at Blog Talk Radio, and let us know what you think and let us know your feelings on this and share your thoughts and experiences and even tips you have when it comes to, you know, scene safety and it comes to, you know, how you think you would respond. I mean, even sharing that would be great, I think, as well, you know. So, Josh, I do want to say hi real quick to my recent Twitter followers before we end. Blake Hurst, Angel Guard, Jason Lionberg, that's a pretty cool last name, Eddie Briggs, and also Boston EMS, all new Twitter followers for me. If anyone listening wants to follow me on Twitter, I am at EMS Safe, and you can check me out on Twitter there as well, and of course that'll be in the show notes. Josh, thanks for joining me as always.
Yep, as always, pleasure.
All right. Thanks to John in the chat room at One Union 801, the webcast. Thanks to Pioneer Girl as well for keeping it lively in the chat room. And like you said, RJ Rescue Humor showed up as well. Appreciate him popping in for a few minutes and saying hi. You can go check out Rescue Humor over on Facebook and check out his Facebook page there as well. Become one of his Facebook fans. He's got some pretty interesting photos and whatnot on his fan page, so go check that out. All right, Josh, just about out of time, so thanks a lot, and we shall see you next week. All right, everybody, that's it for tonight. Again, any questions, comments, you want to share some thoughts or see a topic brought up here at EMS Office Hours, be sure to send it over to me. My email is jhoffman@ems-safety.com, and I'd love to go ahead and create a episode on something that you are passionate about in EMS. So send that over to me, and be sure to tweet us out, join us on Facebook, or make comments in the blog over at emsofficehours.com. Until next week, guys, as always, Jim Hoffman, stay safe.